Good people, my name is Camille Williams-Taylor. While I'm currently in the role of Director of Education in Ontario, I still and always will identify as a teacher. I started in education in 1986 as an education assistant and became a teacher in 1989, 33 years ago at the time of this recording. I'm a Black Caribbean woman with a proud Jamaican heritage. I came to Canada as a teenager, as my family put down new roots in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Today, I am a sister, a wife, a daughter, and a mom and stepmom to six daughters. I'm going to use this podcast space to talk about personal and professional leadership as a racialized person in a dominant white culture reality. And I'm also going to direct my comments to people who share a similar lived experience who are navigating their way professionally, as well as to dominant culture folks who hold influential positions in leadership in some aspect of the education system. Recently, someone asked me why I use the term dominant culture. I use this term to respect the intersectionality of identity and that race is one thing, but other aspects of identity, like faith, sexual, and gender identity, also inform in-groups and out-groups, that sense of belonging. I also want to acknowledge before I begin that these are my reflections, some of which will be shared by my colleagues and friends who have similar lived experiences and identify as I do, but I'm confident that some of my peers, colleagues of color in leadership roles, will have differing views. Growing up as a child in Jamaica, the gifts, excellence, performance, and achievement of Black people was a given and was exemplified everywhere. Our doctor, dentists, teachers, and community leaders all look like us. Our stories were told at school, and success was noted and celebrated not as an anomaly, but rather as a manifestation of hard work and talent. Performance, dignity, and success were expected. And leadership was not a surprise. As an adolescent, my move to Canada placed me in a whole new reality. I was, and sometimes I still am, reminded that my words are too big, I'm too opinionated, I took things too seriously, and as I made my way as an adult professional, there were occasions where I felt that I was being reminded to mind my place. People didn't actually say those words, but as Simon Sinek points out, people behave what they believe, and the messages were clear in the behaviors. When people struggle to get your name right or mix you up with the other Black girl or the other Black woman all the time, the message is that you're not really that special, important, or unique, and that you're not even seen or heard. In my home, in my community, and among my friends, differing opinions are expected. Questions are a reflection of intelligence, and debates are frequent, passionate, and escalating in volume. Animated discussions are part of my authentic reality. As a professional and emerging leader, however, questions from me and animated debate were sometimes seen as disruptive and angry. Comments like, "You're raising your voice, you're making me uncomfortable," are strategies that I experienced that were used to signal control and silence the conversation if the points I was raising were uncomfortable. So what does all that have to do with a leadership message? What I'm sharing is a glimpse into some of the experiences lived by Black people and people of color who bring their authentic selves into the school systems, cultures, and bureaucracies that are not built for them, not built for us. Code switching becomes the norm, shaping language, words, the way we tell stories, carefully to ensure that we don't offend. Code switching means asking questions very cautiously and positioning disagreement quietly and subtly so that the disagreement is not registered as anger or criticism. All this takes work, it's stressful, and it erodes confidence. It requires people, leaders, to navigate in the shadows and sometimes to shrink. It results in Black leaders and leaders of color being overlooked or unseen. But as this is being recorded in February, Black History Month, it's a great space to shed a light on leaders who have gone ahead and paved the way and paved an emerging path, opening spaces for talent to be seen. In Ontario, education leaders like the late Harold Brathwaite, leaders like Zenaida Akande and Dr. Avis Glaze, Bernice Blackman, former superintendent, Dr. Elizabeth Artwell Sinclair, and the late Dr. Patrick Solomon are just a few people who are examples of those who embrace leadership in education, in academia, and in politics at a time when equity, anti-racism, and inclusion were still peripheral concepts. Nice to have, but neither central nor essential to advancing education. Yet, these leaders centered that conversation and modeled strategic and possible leadership as Black leaders in the Ontario landscape. More importantly, they modeled strategies and approaches that were essential for Black leaders and leaders of color to exercise influence, manifest talent, achieve success, and make change while keeping and holding on to their authentic selves. So what were these strategies? I'm going to identify three. The first of these strategies is to lead with preparation. Be informed, be skilled, be credentialed. When the opportunity comes, it's important to be ready. The second thing is to be generous with your time and committed to the success of other people. Reaching back and reaching out to sponsor and support others into leadership creates a network, a community of practice. This is where opportunities are opened up. This is where, in this network, there is friendly and constructive critique. This is where the challenges of racism and othering are acknowledged, where fears and frustration are heard and validated, and then the tools to put yourself back together are forged in this space and with this network. It is in the network that the elders are recognized and new talent is nurtured and protected. And it is in the network that courage is nourished and self-doubt is extinguished. And this brings me to the third key consideration, key strategy, and that's courage. The reality is, as Black educators and educators of color, we walk a path into leadership roles that is of increasing responsibility. That path becomes more narrow as we move along, and the company of peers becomes smaller. Folks often find themselves to be the only one, whether it's the only one on the team, the only one in the family of schools, or in a specific role in our district. One time I heard a young Black lawyer speaking as a panelist to a group of young women, and she told them not to be afraid to be the only one. It is an inevitable part of the journey. Plow ahead, strive for the goal, reach back, and connect to the network. But as a system, we're wasting talent, opportunity, and potential when we limit the avenues to leadership to only people who represent a singular reality, voice, image, or perspective. In Revisionist History, it's a podcast I like to listen to, Malcolm Gladwell shares an illuminating perspective on how being the only one or being the first impacts that lived reality of the individual in that position. His story is told through the life and times of Sammy Davis Jr. in the episode called A Hug Felt Around the World. It's a hard story to listen to, but it illuminates the struggle to first survive and then to thrive, the impact of tokenism. He references Rosabeth Cantor, who researched and wrote about female identifying tokens in male-dominated environments and how that token experience interfered with their ability to maximize their potential. Her perspective is that the reason they were not doing well, women in, alone in these male-dominated environments, was that there were not enough of them to create a community or a network where they could create attachments, share and support each other naturally and with ease. In other words, they did not have a space in which to be their authentic selves. This is where I'll shift to considerations for leaders who represent the dominant culture in general and white leaders in specific. When we think back to Peggy McIntosh's famous Invisible Knapsack article, it's reasonable to say, to draw, that when you are a member, a leader within the dominant culture, you know the codes, the unwritten rules, the passwords. You usually know what to expect in most professional settings. That there are going to be people who look like you, know your analogies, understand the context of your jokes. That there's going to be food that you can eat. And that the context of your comments and conversation will have a shared foundation and therefore be easily understood. So we can coach people to fit in to an existing structure. But all that gets us is sameness, and as I said before, a waste of talent. We're then deprived of the richness of multiple perspectives that comes from a variety of lived experiences. If we agree that engaging our learners and our communities effectively requires representation and connection, authenticity and trust, then we need to draw on leadership models that invite people to bring the fullness of their authentic selves into their roles as leaders. We have to ensure that identity is valued and that that value is demonstrated. We can reserve judgment and ask a question, seek to understand, disrupt assumptions, and assume excellence. As an emerging leader over the course of my career, I benefited from that value. While I had a network who shared and valued my identity, I also had mentors and coaches who saw my value, asked for my perspective, sponsored and encouraged me to take responsible roles, and urged me to consider progressive and sometimes uncomfortable opportunities. I was encouraged to prepare and be prepared. In some cases, these mentors and coaches, people who we might, in our emerging language, call co-conspirators, didn't always look like me or share my lived experience, but they used their influence to mitigate and remove barriers as they reached back to pull me forward, as each of us is called to do in whatever roles we sit in now. Disrupting the status quo is always difficult. It is painful and it's sometimes risky. Disrupting the status quo is also necessary. It's a necessary step if improvement is going to happen. As we embrace the commitment to shift the way leadership looks, feels, and unfolds in education, I would urge all of us to continue to study, be prepared, to question without agenda, exercise the humility to learn, and to act with empathy and courage as we share our stories and look into each other's realities with a view to opening a space for leadership to emerge in a very different way in our districts and in our profession. Thank you.